So here's what's on my mind this week. Okay, I'm starting to think about Hanukkah. I want to share with you how the Sichot and the Shiurim. What's this? Is a problem?
No, we don't need two recordings.
Okay. Okay, how the Sichot and the Shiurim of the Rosh Hashivos in our day radically altered Hanukkah experience for me, and I think for other people. And you can access a lot of these Shiurim online on the VBM. I've summarized some of them. At its core, Hanukkah is about the oil. And probably the most radical expression of that is 100 answers to the Beis Yosef's Kasha. So it's a constant example of people drilling down into a very, very specific detail. It's a beautiful, but it's not really, it doesn't really help understand Hanukkah that well. I mean, it's a couple of the answers. I once gave a shiur, which you can look up in Yitar, which I tried to summarize, like the 100 answers. By categories, rather than just going through 100 answers, just what are the different categories of answers, like nafkaminas, to cluster them. So you don't have to go through each 100, but these types of answers suggest the following strategy. These types of answers suggest the following strategy. So you certainly are fleshing out Hanukkah a little bit, but even if you flesh out the miracle of the oil, at some point, you ask yourself, there are many miracles in the second Beis HaMikdash. None of them warranted an 8-day holiday. Okay, so there's something very symbolic and very iconic about the oil. Oil is Torah, oil is Tahara, oil is Beis HaMikdash. But at a certain point, if Hanukkah is just about the oil, and it just inheres within the oil, especially since the details of the actual miracle are very, very murky, or at least they're not in Tanakh. We can get the historical details of Sefer Machabim, but you're not going to read Sefer Machabim like you'd read Sefer Megillas Esther, with the diukim, with the poetry, with the linguistic issues. You're not going to make a diuk why Sefer Machabim is written this way as opposed to that way. So at a certain point, Hanukkah becomes either very, very, very speculative, you're far off from any sources because there are no sources, or it becomes very picayune, but you just... So the shiur become about Torah and Torah Shebal Peh and important topics, but not really Hanukkah-related issues. And just Hanukkah-hinged issues, anchored to Hanukkah. But the conversations aren't really about Hanukkah, because there's not much to talk about. There's some murky military victory. We don't really know. And I think Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein opened our minds on two fronts. And I'll share with you the front. I'm going to close the door. The front that Rav Lichtenstein opened, and then maybe next week or some other time, Rav Amital's front. Rav Amital's front was discussing the restored autonomy and the Rambam and Chazon Malchus Yisrael and its consequences for the state of Israel and for restored Jewish sovereignty. And it also helped that Rav Amital arrived in Israel, I think it was the second day of Hanukkah, or the third day of Hanukkah. I have to look up the story. But that became his Yom Tov, and we celebrated with him at the Masibah. And every year he reevaluated what Zionism meant and what Reshit Tzmichas Gula Seinu was. It was really fresh and vibrant because he was always undergoing change. He was a person that always changed. I think the most ironic story I ever heard is someone once did his thesis on Rav Amital, his doctorate on Rav Amital. Several people did it. But he did his doctorate on how Rav Amital always changed his mind. That was his doctorate. This is too good a story to be true, so I'm assuming it's apocryphal. He came over to Rav Amital and showed him the thesis, and Rav Amital said, I don't really like it so much. And the guy went away, and the Rav Amital came and said, you know what, I changed my mind. Something like that. Again, it sounds like it's a set-up story, but something to that nature. So Rav Amital was always redistilling what Reish HaSmichas Gula Seinu was, and inevitably it was either the Hanukkah Sicha or the Yom HaTzimut Sicha. That was Rav Amital. Rav Lichtenstein did something very different for us, and I find that it's very singular. I haven't found it anywhere else. There's a tendency to either or both, okay, ignore the larger interaction between the Jews and the Greeks, which is unfurling over hundreds of years. And in addition, even if you think about those interactions, just as cast the Greeks and Greek culture as the naked fools running through the streets of Athens, screaming Eureka, hedonistic, homosexual, corrupt, morally deranged, and we protected humanity from that. And it's so inaccurate. Not just inaccurate, schizophrenic, because everyone alive today draws so much of their life and experience from Greek philosophy and Greek science and Greek math and Greek politics and Greek democracy and Greek art and Greek culture and Greek civilization. So either to ignore what Greece was or to address it and just to set up the Greeks as some straw man to be defeated by the conquering Maccabees, and they were evil and corrupt, and we saved humanity. It's just so unfair. And I said, this is what's schizophrenic, because anytime you describe something that doesn't really exist, you can describe it and pontificate it about it, but then you don't live it. And if you don't live it, it doesn't stretch into reality. So you have two realities, the you when you're learning about it or talking about it or giving a share about it, then the you when you're... And that's the major problem with Mussar. When people read the Maseilas Yesharim, Maseilas Yesharim describes a world that very, very few people inhabit today. It's a world of darkness and emptiness and futility and defeat and mazes we don't have the keys for. So if you decide to live that life and move to Emei Yesharim, then that could become your reality. It's a perfect prescription for a moral and religious life. But if you sit in the Beis Medrash and chuckle away and learn Maseilas Yesharim, and then you go to the Yankee game in your SUV and you stop off at a restaurant for some pastrami sandwich, and then you go on a vacation and you celebrate the latest inventions, latest vaccines, you're creating a rift between the religious mindset you're trying to create and the life you're leading. And that creates religious schizophrenia. And it's not just schizophrenic, it becomes religiously shallow because you're not really processing. It doesn't sink into the depths of your identity, because the depths of your identity are how you live. Sometimes if you're just inserting some religious chip into your heart that you call upon when necessary, rather than defining you and characterizing you. So I think the same thing with Hanukkah and with the Greeks. Or if Lichtenstein would every year describe what Greece stood for, what their contributions were to humanity, and where particularly we differed from them. And we never quoted this Maharal, but to me it was all based on the following Maharal. The Maharal believes that the four empires that visited this planet and dominated humanity, that the Jews struggled with, these are not just political or military struggles, but each of these empires challenged humanity with particularly dangerous moral and religious ideas. And that the Jewish people, being that we are the defenders of history, we tussled with these empires. We didn't tussle with the Incas or the Indians or some second-rate country. We tussled with the great empires. And that tussle was an intellectual and cultural challenge. We were protecting humanity. The Rav spoke about combining the Rav and the Maharal and Rav Amital. He spoke about this a lot. That's why the Jews are compared to Chol Hayam. Chol Hayam is that the sand protects the dry land against the encroachment of the sea. So the Koch V'Hashemayim is one meaning, one metaphor. And the Afar Haaretz is another metaphor. But the Chol Hayam has a specific function. So there's some challenge taking place between Greece and Yerushalayim, between Athens and Yerushalayim. And Rav Aaron helped me, and I think some other people appreciate that larger story for Hanukkah. And every year Hanukkah, sort of think about what did they represent, where do we differ, how do we contribute. I later found that this is also latent in the Kuzari. The Kuzari believes that, he doesn't say the word Hanukkah, but he does describe the children of Yefes inhabiting a more northern area, Greece and the Baltic areas, and then having to descend southerly to visit the Jews to receive truth that couldn't be proven scientifically, but truth that can only be proven prophetically. Because according to the Kuzari, of course, all belief is based on prophecy. And the children of Shem are the prophetic line, and children of Yefes are the analytic line. He doesn't talk about Hanukkah, but I think it's implicit in his statement. So what happened over this period? What did the Greeks accomplish? Where did we differ from them? Okay, so first of all, there are two events that happened before Hanukkah that frame Hanukkah. Hanukkah is about 160 BCE, just to give you a sense of 200 years or so, 230 years before the Churban Beis HaMikdash Sheni. Okay? Now, about 140 years earlier, maybe 150 years earlier, Alexander the Great visits Yerushalayim. He has his famous encounter with Shimon HaTzadik. And he wants to destroy Yerushalayim, and some of the Sumerians, Shomronim, are encouraging this. And instead of taking Shimon HaTzadik as hostage, because he's the leader of the Jewish people, he dismounts his horse and he bows down to Shimon HaTzadik, and his viceroys ask him, why are you showing such honor to this old Jew? And he says, because this is the old Jew that comes to me in my dreams before every military victory. I want to show him some courtesy and some honor. And then he wanted to put an idol into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, into the Azara, and Shimon HaTzadik prevented him. And then Shimon HaTzadik, instead of being victimized by the Shomronim, he then sicks Alexander on the Shomronim, and he's able to defeat them. What you have here is you have the representative of Greece. Maybe I should take a step back, okay? It's really important that I make this point. The war was not with Greek soldiers. The war was with northern Assyrian Seleucids. But Greece had extended its cultural, intellectual influence over the entire region. So even if you interviewed the average Greek soldier or the average Greek Seleucid who was issuing the decree and you asked him, are you coming in the name of Plato and Aristotle and Greek philosophy? He'd say, no, I don't know. I don't know these people. I live in Assyria. I'm just loosely affiliated with the Greek Empire. But certainly metaphysically, in the morals and the metaphysics, there's some larger episode taking place. So it's really important, again, that we operate on two realms. We operate at the actual cognitive realm, just like anti-Semitism. You interview your average anti-Semite, he's not going to quote Psukim from Zechariah, he's not going to quote Allah Hassan Esav son of Yaakov, he's not going to quote the Gemara and Shabbos, Lamanik Rosh Masim, Meshiach Hassan of the Olam. But we believe there are larger forces at work in this cosmological drama that we're a part of. Now, where the balance between that and Bechir Chavshis lies is an interesting question. Right? If I'm an anti-Semite, I have the right to hate a Jew or not hate a Jew. But there's a larger trajectory at which there's going to be a lot of hatred directed towards Jews. That's always a question, right? It's a question about redemption. Of course, Baruch is a predetermined redemptive end, and yet we have freedom of choice to determine its pace and its shape and its speed. So it's the same thing here. It may have been the northern Seleucid fighters who never opened a book of Plato or Greek science or Greek philosophy, but you still have the sense that this is a conflict between ideas that the Jews represent and that the Greek Empire represents. If not actually, then at least metaphysically. Okay, so Alexander is searching. Greece is searching. The description of the Khuzari, obviously written 1,000 years later, more than 1,000 years later, but the description of the Khuzari is coming true. Yefes is descending southerly, or in this case, southeasterly, to Yerushalayim from the Greek Mediterranean islands towards Yerushalayim to discover some truths. And this isn't a battle. This encounter ends very peacefully, very collaboratively. He dismounts his horse. He bows down to Alexander Mokdon. About 100 years before Hanukkah, so let's place it at 260 BCE, you have another very interesting encounter between Ptolemy II, who is a Greek ruler in Egypt, who translates the Tanakh for the first time into a foreign language, that foreign language being Greek. Ancient Greek. So before Hanukkah ever happens, there's a framework of cultural, intellectual, and religious interaction. Now, often whenever there is some encounter, two things are going to happen. Sometimes an encounter will flare into violence, and decrees, and discrimination. That's what happens in Hanukkah. There's also going to be backwash. Not only are Greeks being influenced by Jews, but Jews are being influenced by Greeks. Hellenization. So the two aspects of Hanukkah don't just erupt in some historical vacuum. All of a sudden, the year 160, some Greek king decided to decree against the Jews, and Jews defended themselves. There's a historical framework to it. And that historical framework is crucial to us understanding Hanukkah. Now, what did the Greeks bring to civilization? Only by understanding what they bring to civilization and their massive contribution to civilization, both in the general areas, but in particular in religion, because we're discussing religion, we don't believe the Greeks pose great hazards in science and art, but the challenges were moral and religious. So let's understand how they changed the world, how they changed the world religiously, but where they threatened to corrupt moral and religious thought, and where the Jewish people made it stand intellectually by defeating the Greeks, and how history has changed since, and how history would be different, not just for Jews, but for humanity at large. So obviously Greece introduced science, scientific inquiry, order. The word cosmos means the word order in Greece. It changed a world which is random and arbitrary to a world which is ordered and predictable and manageable. And it took the fear and the anxiety. Ancient man lived a very anxious life. You didn't know what was going to afflict you, what rainstorm, what pterodactyl, what brontosaurus, what natural calamity. But by predicting and trying to diagnose and organize the world, knowledge is power. Predictability is power. So Greece took away the anxiety from human experience. We'll talk about that issue of anxiety in religion a little bit later. Obviously science, politics, math, art, democracy. In many respects, it's the first civilization. It's the first time that the Jewish people are encountering a civilization. Until then, we had squared off against barbarians, basically. Every single empire that we encountered was barbaric. Certainly you see this in Persia. The entire Megillas Esther is a conflict between a law-abiding society and a society that makes fun of its laws, that creates laws about how to drink wine, creates laws how to laws about pornography, basically, a pornographic beauty contest to select the queen. And Chazal liken Persia to a bear, the scavenger, this bear that has too much flesh on its body for its own good. But Greece was very organized and ordered. That's why the issue of decrees, Gazru Gezeros, when the Rambam describes the Nes of Chanukah, the Medrash has this a lot, that Greece is defined by Gezeros, because it doesn't seem as if the Jewish people were facing decrees. Decrees come from an organized, politically intact society that issues decrees and enforces decrees. Achashverosh had a sense of letter writing. I'm writing a letter based on whim. I'll write this letter, I'll write a new letter. Here, the Greeks are not issuing letters, they're issuing decrees, Gazru Gezeros. So this is the first time the Jewish people encountering a civilization worthy of this battle, worthy of this competition, so to speak. But the major contribution of Greece, in my opinion, and what makes it most helpful in some ways, most threatening in other ways, is that they're starting to move away from ancient paganism. So if you compare the ancient paganism, not all this are things we're looking to talk about, but it's my elaboration based on his setup. Ancient pagans worshipped very, very physical, gross, as in vulgar, mean, not mean as in angry, but mean and what we're looking for, physical, and so they worshipped trees, and they worshipped seasons, and they worshipped the oceans, and they worshipped animals, and they worshipped the winds. And Greece was starting to move towards a more abstract concept of God, and certainly in Plato, and Aristotle, but even in Greek mythology. And I'm not, for the moment, discussing the relationship between high Greek philosophy and Greek mythology. But even if you interviewed your average Greek citizen and asked him to describe his gods, he would laugh at the prospect of bowing down to an animal, which his predecessors wouldn't have. He would laugh at you, bowing down to an animal, bowing down to an ocean, bowing down to a molten image. No, I worship, whatever worship meant for the Greeks, I worship the gods on Mount Olympus. And those gods are ethereal, they're spirits. You can't really see them. You're able to hear them and speak to them. Sometimes they'll take physical form just to appear to us because they couldn't imagine fully transcendent. But there's a move towards transcendence. There's a move towards non-physical. They're not paganists, they're theists. They're starting to comprehend that God is different from them and is non-physical, which is a major leap forward for the human imagination. We take it for granted because we live thousands of years downstream from, of course, the chosen people. So we were told this at our Sinai. But for humanity to discover this, it takes them a couple of millennia to imagine a God who doesn't have horns and isn't an animal and isn't a wind or a season. What they had a harder time with was the other basic doctrine of monotheism. Not just that Hashem is invisible, but Hashem is also one and is responsible for all reality. Of course, thus the two mesh. Hashem is one. Because he's not physical. He's physical, he's not one in a way that we can't describe. We don't know anything that's not physical because we don't know anything that's indivisible. Hashem is the sole cause for all creation, and he's indivisible. So if you're looking for the formal term, they're not paganists, they're polytheists. Theists, their idea of God is theoretical, but theos God, but they're polytheists. And you read Greek mythology and you read this illustrious stories of all the various gods. These gods are still not fully transcendent. They still interact with human beings, they still have marital relations with human beings, they still steal from human beings, they still... But the march towards monotheism has officially begun. And by visiting Yerushalayim, we're influencing that march. And this will lead, not just conceptually and metaphysically, this will lead practically to Christianity. Remember, Christianity emerges, depending on when you date it, but it's about 160 years after Hanukkah. And ironically, not so ironically, many of the Greeks become Christians. If you trace these Greeks as they become Greeks and then turn to Romans, they ultimately turn Christian. Some of the early Greeks, some of the early Christians, that's why the Bibles are written in Greek. Some of the early Christians, so you're creating a mindset that allows them to become monotheistic. And even though we despise Christianity's historical record because it's so discriminatory and persecuting the Jews, we're happy that humanity is inching its way closer to its monotheism. We prefer Christianity to the ancient paganism of the Tanakh. So Greece is not just providing science, technology, art, culture, democracy, politics. It's also creating significant religious change. So the question is, what are they threatening? What are the ideas of greed that threatens us? I made a little bit of a list here. Let me just make sure I don't forget anything. First of all, in the Greek religious world, there is no intimacy and no relationship between a human being and God. Gods have powerful forces. You can try to bribe them and draft them, and it's still the ancient pagan influence. But there's no sense of a relationship. The relationships are ad hoc. They're rape. They're sexual. But there's no... And one of the great achievements of Judaism is, on the one hand, and Rav Kook writes about this with Hakadosh Yitzchak, on the one hand, to unwaveringly defend the transcendence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We can't know him, we can't describe him, we can't imagine him, we can't even articulate him, and still to create a relationship of passion and emotion and love and commitment. And that was Avram's final message for humanity. So to speak, to paraphrase, the challenge to Avram on the eve of the Akedah, okay, Avram, you've proven to us you can believe in a transcendent one God, but can you enter into a relationship with a transcendent God that you can't touch and see and feel and hold and wear around your neck? And that has been the Jewish legacy, to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu so deeply, even though, if you think about it, it's an astounding accomplishment. It's trying to burn the candle at both ends. Hashem is unknowable, but he's not just a theoretical principle or a value that we believe in, but he's also part of our lives in a way that we make a real, we don't just believe in him, but we love him. That's Hashem Elokecha, that's Hashem Elokecha Tira. That whole emotional landscape between man and God is completely absent from Plato. It is completely absent from Aristotle. That's number one. Second aspect that's completely absent is mitzvahs. God is not a commander. Man doesn't live with commandments to follow and obey God's transcendent will. At most, gods provide moral examples. Again, there's a little bit of a difference between the God of Plato and the God of Greek mythology. So the God of Plato does provide moral example. The gods of Greek mythology certainly do not provide moral examples to human beings. But the notion of commandments, of Mesuva V'Yosef, is being threatened. Will humanity live a life of commandment? And we see that even Christianity has emasculated some of that, because in Christianity, especially not Christianity, but Protestantism. So in the more modern emanation of Christianity, part of the Protestant Revolution was to limit ceremony and ritual in favor of values and ideals. It's very Greek in that respect. It's a return to value and ideals and a movement away from commandments. Number three is that in the world of Greece, there's no mention of charity and supporting the weak. The weak are left to fend for themselves. The weak are cast off into the margins of society. The ethos that's so powerful in the Torah, V'ger lo toneh, mishbayasam be'almana, and the way that the Tanakh exhorts us to deliver tzedakah and to defend the weak and to extend ourselves, and again, based on the moral example of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if anything, it's the Hercules that are celebrated and the strong who survive. It's a little Darwinian in that respect. Darwin, of course, is not a religious treatise, but it is a bit of the strong will survive and the weak are cast aside to fend for themselves. And these are two or three of the challenges that Greece is providing the world and the Jewish people, through the Jewish people, because the Jewish people are the vanguard of humanity. Another aspect that's interesting, the difference between Greece and Yerushalayim, I've thought about a lot more this year. You see, what happens is, how did Greece change the world from random and arbitrary into organized and predictable? It did it by moving away from the particular and moving toward the general. That even though we all live through specific experiences, they're merely expressions of something more general, more universalistic, categorical, or brisker in that respect. We're always trying to define categories. The most potent example is Platonic thought. What's the theory of Plato of Platonic thought? So the metaphor that Plato developed was as follows. That imagine you're sitting in a cave, and you can't see the world outside of you because your back is to the world. But you light a fire. And everything taking place outside of the cave you see as a shadow on the wall. So you're seeing not reality, but you're seeing a shadow of reality. Similarly, when we're sitting, let's say, at this table doesn't really exist because that's too particularistic. It's here today, gone tomorrow. So, and it's vulnerable to the ravages of time, of fire, and water. There's some Platonic table in heaven. And that's the perfect table, and that's an absolute, and that exists on its own. And this is just the shadow of that table that we're experiencing. So all of a sudden, my experience shifts from the particularistic to the universal. When I'm sitting at this table, I should be thinking about the platonic table, the platonic horse. People use the word platonic today to describe non-romantic relationships, but the real word platonic is there's some ideal image of every experience and every object and every human being, and we're just operating in the shadows. So you're lifting experience away from the particularistic towards the more generalistic and universal. Now, part of what suffers under that system in general is the concept of time. Because time is very specific. Right now, it is, 11:16 on a particular day, in a particular month, and it's not before, and it's not after. But the more that life is reduced to objectives and absolutes, the less meaningful time is. And Greece does a lot of thinking about how to, not how to measure time, but what's the meaning of time. Man is always speculating, what is the meaning of time? How do you define time? We know that it affects us. We know that it's part of our reality, but what would you define it as? So we call it a dimension, but it's not really a dimension, it's a very, very general word. What is time? And the Greeks started to talk about time as being an illusion. So for Aristotle, I think it was, time doesn't really exist because the past has vanished, the future has yet to happen, so you're living only in that second, in that moment, so time is just an illusion. Or, as other Greek philosophers suggested, time is infinite, which is the same as saying it's an illusion, because it doesn't exist, because it cycles through infinity. Aristotle had some famous, I forget what it was called, the whole famous metaphor between the tortoise and the hare, which is, parable. Not the children's parable between the tortoise and the hare, but a scientific proof that time can't exist. What?
Zeno's parable.
Right, so Zeno. So it doesn't exist. Now, for us, we don't call it time. We call that history. And history means that the arc of time is a very specific genesis, beginning, and a very specific terminus, and there's a surging of history from the genesis towards the terminus. And the terminus was very much like the genesis in its moral condition, its pristine moral state. And that surging from the beginning of time to the end of time is called redemption. It's a movement towards a better place, in a different place. So what they call this nondescript time, which may not even exist or is infinite, and therefore since it's infinite, has no character, we define as history, and history has a very redemptive flavor to it. And in addition to that, it's not just redemptive cycling on its own dynamics, but it's redemptive based on the behavior of man. The moral behavior of man can shape the arc, the pace of that redemption, of course, primarily the Jewish people, because we're the agents of redemption. It's a completely different way to view time. It's antithetically, diametrically opposed. And that's why I think the Greeks were so opposed to Rosh Chodesh. When you think about the three primary decrees, it was Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos, and Milah. Milah is the obvious, because they worship the perfection of the human body, and they, like the Romans did, viewed circumcision as mutilation. Famous debate between Tiridates Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, where Tiridates Rufus says, why are you mutilating humans? But it already starts with Greece. Shabbos is a different story. Shabbos is probably about creation. But Rosh Chodesh is a very different time experience than the solar calendar or any other way to measure time, because it changes, it's altered. Sometimes the moon appears after 30 days and the moon appears after 29 days. And you can manipulate the calendar, not based on the harvest. You can't really manipulate the harvest because you need to stick to the seasons to receive the rain at its proper time, to receive the sun at its proper time. It's based on the bending of the earth. But the moon, you can manipulate time without it really affecting your reality. In theory, it's not going to make a difference. 29 days or 30 days. It won't make a difference for tides and other peripheral aspects of human condition. So I think it rankled them that the Jews felt themselves empowered to shape history and to shape time. And I think that to me is one of the main differences that I sense. We read so much into what does it mean to live a life of redemption, to be an agent of redemption, to live in history. What's the difference between, I was thinking about it after this week because of the overlap, the very, very rare overlap between Thanksgiving and between Hanukkah, normally between Hanukkah and Christmas. But this is between Hanukkah and Thanksgiving. And think about how we recall Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, and how Americans recall Thanksgiving. Okay, as much of my thesis tonight is that most of Western history is still influenced by the Jews, less by the Greeks. And I think most of the modern world has bought into history as redemptive. And Certainly, modern religions, Christianity and Islam, see history as redemptive. And the question is, before I get back to Thanksgiving, how does that affect society? A society that views itself as part of a redemptive arc is more likely to produce discoverers and inventors and crusaders for social justice and political revolutionaries, because you live in an imperfect world that could become more perfect through change in human effect, as opposed to just living in a world of shadows. In the world of Plato, how can I really, I can predict my world, can I analyze my world, can I really change the world? After all, I'm not even sitting at a table, I'm sitting at a projection of a table. I can't influence a table in heaven. Whereas I believe I'm part of a redemptive drama, I want to discover, I want to invent, I want to improve, because I see that as redemptive. In some broader sense, I see this as contributing to the march of humanity towards Jerusalem, towards the Promised Land. It's fascinating to read the pilgrims who arrive at the, in the United States and call it Jerusalem and are immersed in biblical, theological prophecies, and as if they're discovering that Promised Land. And Promised Land and Jerusalem become a metaphor throughout all literature, throughout all philosophy. The better tomorrow that we seek. And yes,
I'm thinking that those ideas are necessarily antithetical. Like, I know that in like a lot of Muslim literature, they talk about like the ideal person that you want to be and the actual person you are, and how to match the form to the ideal. And I understand that like to negate like reality and the redemptive process is negative. Maybe is there a way to combine the two ideas?
You're asking two separate questions. I haven't read as much Musa as maybe you have. I haven't seen that same radicalization of a Platonic ideal. I think in Musa you're basically, yeah, this is the ideal goal for human beings, and now you try to achieve that ideal. But you exist in your own particularistic identity, and this is a set of standards you should be striving for. Whereas in the Platonic theory, as far as I can tell, you're just a reflection of some ideal. You're not you. You're just a pale reflection, like the cave metaphor. You're just a reflection. So it hollows out human experience. So I think we're using the word ideal very differently. You're using, in Musser, ideal is the paradigm, the paragon, the highest epitome. Whereas in Plato, the ideal, it's only the ideal that exists. Everything else is just a projection. But I think, how do we experience memory? Like I think when I think of Hanukkah, I don't just recall an event that happened thousands of years ago and celebrate it because I'm a Jew and I come from that lineage. I believe that the historical cycles that, or the experiences of Hanukkah, are recycled through history. So to me, it's not memory; it's experience. I'm not recalling. How many Americans will celebrate Thanksgiving and imagine that the experience of the original pilgrims is recycling to their world? Only in a very, very, very loose way. That they gave thanks to God, so we would give thanks to them. I mean, only diminishing its importance, but it's a very, very shallow extrapolation. And we're not celebrating Hanukkah because they gave thank you to Hashem, and therefore we give thank you. They were saved, therefore we dig deep into what the metaphors are of Hanukkah, what really changed in Hanukkah, and then we find parallel conditions in our world. Because it's a view of history that assumes recyclability. The patterns that are already established are going to be relevant thousands of years later because it's all part of one organic search towards a redemptive endpoint. So what happened before is part of this search rather than being in the past that already has expired and therefore is an illusion. So I think that the way we experience time, which is so crucial to Jews and so crucial to redemptive history, is also a product of this mind of defense that the Jewish people create. And to me, the phrase that captures all this, the word olamecha to me implies that Hanukkah has applications and connotations beyond the Jewish people. For just that the Jewish people recognize that Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's v'lachasi z'shem gadol v'kadosh b'yamecha. Yelamecha sounds like there's a world, humanity at large, is receiving the Shem Gadol V'Kadosh. Again, in a more literal way, the word Kadosh always means transcendence. Kadosh doesn't mean holiness. Kadosh means beyondness and transcendence. So obviously, it reaffirmed that Kadosh Baruch Hu's transcendence, because the Greeks did challenge some of that, because even though they were theists, the gods were still closer to physical than we would like them to be. So Shem Kadosh, but the word Shem Gadol sounds like, even though we don't have a sense of Hanukkah being recognized, as far as I know, by the broad. It's not chronicled in the same way that, let's say, it sounds like Purim was. Certainly Mitzrayim was. We have parallel accounts of Mitzrayim. Sounds like some of the events of Purim were chronicled in the Divrei Hayamim for Achashverosh, as written in his books. We don't really have that in Hanukkah. We don't really see other historians. To a degree, it's a little bit before Josephus, so you don't really have historians to narrate the chronicle. But I don't think it's the people who got up and recognized Hanukkah and said, my goodness, I could have Baruch Hu saved humanity. But with the slow passage of time, the Hanukkah event created certain patterns, or preserved certain patterns against the encroachment of Greek culture. So these are just some of the ideas that Rivaran expressed, or some of the ideas that I've read about and thought about, but I never would have discovered or even thought about them without Rav Lichtenstein creating a paradigm shift in my mind. And Hanukkah is something a little bit larger. If you're looking for a nice article to start on Rav Lichtenstein, a nice starter manual, like an opening course, or he has a great, just from a literary standpoint, I just think it's stunning. He used the following contrast to differentiate between Greek culture and Judaism. He contrasted Eof with Prometheus. The common denominator between them is two individuals rail against perceived divine injustice. Eof would say, for Eof and Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods, was chained to a rock. And he details how Greek literature casts Prometheus, how Tanakh casts Eof, and that casting reflects the different values. It's just a very interesting way to go about it. I summarize it in one of the YU shiurims. I think there's only one shiur that you look for Moshe Tarek with the word Prometheus. Or, you know, if you just go right to Prometheus. I'm saying there's only one shiur in all of YU. That'd be an interesting challenge. Is there any shiur in YU Torah aside from mine that has the word Prometheus in it? Probably not. But just do a search in Prometheus and you'll find that shiur. It's a summary. Why don't you just download the VBM shiur and download the VBM shiur and read it yourself. But I'm sure in the VBM you have plenty of these shiur. Like I said, it was just, as you would say, mind-blowing. It just turned my mind around in ways that I hadn't been prepared to think about it beforehand.
I yeah? think you're the only one.
That was a good prediction. Okay. Baruch Hashem, it's good to...